true with some of the great moments in British music during the first half of the 20th century, but also a week with some puzzling questions. Why did Elgar boycott the coronation? Why did he feel more for the horses than the soldiers of the Great War? Our composer of the week is Edward Elgar. Weekday lunchtimes next week at 12 noon on BBC Radio 3.
Well, the time now is just after 1 o'clock. This is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and also online. I'm Jill Anderson and here's a summary of the news. David Cameron is setting out plans to make tax havens more transparent. He's meeting the leaders of 10 of Britain's overseas territories, including Bermuda and Jersey, to press them to take more action on tax evasion and avoidance. He also wants shell companies in the UK to declare who ultimately profits from their work. Scotland Yard is to take over the investigation into the disappearance of Madeleine McCann. The Home Secretary, Theresa May, has agreed to fund the inquiry. A review of the case by the Metropolitan Police discovered several potential new leads, but the police in Portugal have not reopened the case. Early results from Iran's presidential election put the moderate conservative Hassan Rouhani in the lead. Official figures show that he's won just half of about 12 million votes counted so far. Six Libyan soldiers have been killed in Benghazi after gunmen attacked an elite army base in the city. Heavy gunfire and explosions were heard from late at night until early morning. Two of the soldiers appear to have been executed after being taken hostage. It's part of a continuing struggle between government forces and militia for control of the city. A group of Turkish protesters in Istanbul say they'll continue their occupation of Gezi Park, despite the government proposing a referendum on the area's future. A plan to redevelop the park has led to a series of anti-government demonstrations in the country. The grandson of Nelson Mandela has said the former South African president is recovering well from a lung infection, which has kept him in hospital for a week. Mandla Mandela said his 94-year-old grandfather looked good. Google is launching 30 balloons high into the air in an attempt to provide internet access to remote or poor parts of the world. The balloons will circle the globe at more than 60,000 feet, roughly twice the altitude used by most commercial aircraft. They're equipped to beam wireless signals to internet users below. And the weather. It'll be a rainy afternoon for central and southern Scotland. The rest of the UK should see sunny spells with some showers. Well, that's the BBC News and Weather. And now it's time for the first of this weekend's editions of the Early Music Show. Here's Catherine Bott.
Welcome to the first in a rather unusual pair of early music shows. As part of Radio 3's current celebration of British music and musicians, today and tomorrow I'm going to be investigating the tremendous and fully acknowledged debt owed by one great English composer to another. The debtor here is Benjamin Britten, his benefactor, Henry Purcell. When I set to work on these two programmes, I applied the wording of an old-fashioned exam paper. You know the sort of thing. Compare and contrast the work of Benjamin Britten and Henry Purcell, illustrating something of what the former owed to the latter with reference to extended musical extracts. And the task proved hugely rewarding. As Michael Flanders and Donald Swan used to sing in their affectionate, observant Guide to Britain, his work was soon in rehearsal because he always used Purcell. Thank you. I'm sure you spotted where the bread met the filling in that little Britain, Purcell Britain sandwich. The opening theme of Britain's The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra, played by the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by the composer, followed by the tune on which it's based, the rondo from the incidental music to Abdelazar by Purcell, with the period instruments of the Taverner Players, conducted by Andrew Parrott. And then back to the ECO and Britain, with an exhilarating major key summing up of all that had gone before, in a piece originally composed for an educational film. At the end of the Second World War in 1945, Britain was deeply sensitive to veiled accusations of lack of patriotism. He marked the 250th anniversary of the death of Purcell with three works which show the influence of Purcell, the original Orpheus Britannicus, the Holy Sonnets of John Donne, The Young Person's Guide, and his second string quartet. The Young Person's Guide is, as we've just heard, full of truly Purcellian harmonic and melodic inventiveness, and all the sounds of the modern orchestra. Those don't, of course, include the viol. Purcell's fantasies from the 1680s for viol consort were astonishingly modern for their time, but by 1945 the viol repertory was of interest to very few. Britain was one of those few. He played the viola and once, very nervously, played the famous one note in Purcell's fantasia of that name in concert. On its first recording, his second string quartet was coupled with the fantasia upon one note at his request. Let's hear Purcell's Fantasia now, played by London Baroque, followed by the Belcher Quartet with the opening movement of Britain's second quartet, so Purcellian in its economy of means and long-held pedal notes, combined with melodic improvisation. A Purcell Fantasy and a movement from a Britten quartet, the first played by London Baroque, the second by the Belcher Quartet. Before I go any further, I ought to make it clear that the last thing I want to do with these comparisons is to imply that Britten's music was merely derivative. You could say that he was actually being very authentic when he modelled his music on that of Purcell. In the Baroque period, to rework someone else's themes or idioms was to pay them a huge compliment. Purcell's music was, rather, precious and inspirational to him, and also symbolised something important. Here's a paragraph from Britten's programme note for the premiere of that second quartet.
Purcell was the last important international figure of English music. Ironically, the continent of Europe has been more aware of his greatness than the island which produced him. But that he should be, to the English public, little more than a name in history books is not altogether strange, for he is the antithesis of the music which has been popular for so long in this country.
Provocative words. But in the years since Britten's death in 1976, a lot has changed for the better. I'll stick my neck out and say that he had quite a lot to do with the English re-evaluation of Purcell's significance. Britten was keen to emphasise Purcell's international qualities, partly to separate himself from the cowpat school of composition. In the early 1960s, he recalled an awkward encounter with a critic who'd asked him who'd influenced his style of setting English verse to music.
I told him Purcell, and he was amazed. I suppose he expected me to say folk music and Vaughan Williams.
Tomorrow's programme will be all about vocal music, but today I'm sticking with instruments. And we're moving on to the bedrock of Baroque keyboard and string repertoire, the dance. Our next music features all the dance movements you'd expect from Purcell, as Richard Egar plays his fifth harpsichord suite, Prelude, Allemande, Courant and Saraband. Followed, unexpectedly but with Baroque authenticity in every bar, by the boisterous bourrée from Britten's Simple Symphony. Benjamin Britten conducting the English Chamber Orchestra in the boisterous Bourré, the opening movement of his Simple Symphony. And before that, Richard Egarr played Purcell's Fifth Suite for harpsichord. Witty interplay between melody and bass in both of those sparkling pieces written more than 200 years apart. Well, Britten had been given endless exercises in writing counterpoint by John Ireland, one of his teachers at the Royal College of Music. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott, today and tomorrow, offering a very personal take on the influence Henry Purcell had on Benjamin Britten. In Purcell's day, the grandest of all instrumental forms was the chaconne, in English, chaconne, or even chaconne, if you prefer, a series of variations on a repeated bass figure. And he was, well, there's no other word, brilliant at them. Purcell himself modestly said that composing on a ground was a very easy thing to do and requires but little judgment. Here's a chaconne from Act 5 of The Faerie Queen. Once again, the English Chamber Orchestra conducted by Benjamin Britten in his own edition of a chaconne from Purcell's Faerie Queen. For this weekend, I've quite deliberately chosen some performances of Purcell that reach our ears through the prism of Britain's own understanding of Purcell's intentions. I'm going to discuss his use of the harpsichord in tomorrow's programme, but I'm already standing by for some listeners to be appalled at the vibrato, the tempo and so on, to which I can only ask everyone to give Britain all possible credit for the truthfulness of his dramatic instinct, and to allow that as a conductor he really brings out all those magical, quirky, inner parts in Purcell's writing. And it's just the same with his performance of Purcell's most famous Chaconne in G minor. the English Chamber Orchestra conducted by Britten in that standalone Chaconne by Purcell. And just to clarify things, Britten has been accused of arranging the work, a word with fearful connotations for Baroque purists. Actually, all he did was transcribe it and add some expression marks. It's no Albinoni Adagio, the notes are Purcell's. As well as being an immortal aria, Dido's Lament is a chaconne, 11 repetitions of an anguished descending phrase. I'm not going to play it today, although I'm sure it'll come to mind. The whole tragedy of the opera is encapsulated in that 10-note phrase. And Britten put the essence of his tortured anti-hero Peter Grimes into an extraordinary, cumulatively overwhelming chaconne. He called it a passacaglia, but the principle is the same. Would Purcell perhaps have understood and admired the intensity of Britten's passacaglia? I like to think so.
Thank you.
Benjamin Britten conducting the orchestra of the Royal Opera House Covent Garden in that Passacaglia from his opera Peter Grimes, ending with a few notes from the role's creator, Peter Piers. As that Passacaglia dies away, Peter Grimes has dragged his terrified young apprentice boy into his clifftop hut, with the mob of the borough not far behind. And there are hints of Purcell even there, in that winding, melismatic vocal writing, so much more than just a rough fisherman shouting, "Go there!" As I said, more on singing tomorrow, when we'll be visiting both the Fairy Queen and Dido and Aeneas. Let's end today with instrumental music from both of those works in Britten's own versions. First, he conducts the ECO in the Dance for the Followers of Night from The Fairy Queen. It's not necessary to know that this is an inverted double canon in order to relish its slightly creepy serenity, but you can bet that Britten would have seen how it worked at a glance. He disliked the intellectual approach, though, saying, "All that is important is that the composer should make his music sound inevitable and right. The system is unimportant." Finally today, we'll hear the overture to Dido and Aeneas, played by the English Opera Group Orchestra in a BBC recording made in 1959.
Thank you.
overture to Purcell's Dido and Aeneas, played there by the English Opera Orchestra, conducted by Benjamin Britten. That Britten Purcell edition of the Early Music Show was presented by Catherine Bott, and the producer in Salford was Paul Frankel. As Catherine said, in tomorrow's edition of the Early Music Show, she'll be comparing and contrasting some of the vocal music of both Britten and Purcell.
Given time, money and two making facilities, I could build a computer that would store all the knowledge mankind has accrued.
Drama on Three tells the story of the man who conceived the computer. Charles Babbage was one of the great scientific brains of the 19th century, but died broke and exhausted. Throughout his life, one extraordinary friendship survived.
How many people understand this machine you want to build? A handful. We must try harder to communicate with the general public.
The public has no interest in scientific papers, or science for that matter. Never has, never will.
Then we must get it interested.
Sam Kelly and Monica Dolan star in Babbage, our drama on Three, tomorrow at 8:30.
Looking ahead to this evening at 6 o'clock, Ivan Hewitt will be introducing Rossini's opera La Donna del Lago, recorded last month at the Royal Opera House Covent Garden. It stars Juan Diego Flores, Joyce Di Donato and Colin Lee, and it's based on Walter Scott's The Lady of the Lake. Rossini's opera illustrates the romantic fascination with Renaissance Scotland as a place of wild emotion and political confrontation. That's our opera tonight, starting at 6 o'clock. That's here on BBC Radio 3. Well, it's just after 2 o'clock now, time for another chance to hear last Monday's live Wigmore Hall concert. The presenter is Sarah Walker.
Welcome to Wigmore Hall, where we're going to be treated to a recital by one of the UK's leading chamber ensembles. The Brodsky Quartet was formed in 1972. Cellist Jacqueline Thomas and violinist Ian Belton are still part of the group today, flanked by Paul Cassidy on viola. He joined in 1982. And Daniel Rowland, who became their first violin in 2007. There are two works on their programme, the String Quartet No. 2 by Benjamin Britten, and firstly, Beethoven's F minor quartet, Opus 95, commonly known as the Serioso, though it ends with a definite burst of high spirits. Beethoven wrote the quartet in 1810 for the Schuppanzig quartet led by a good friend of his, though it took 4 years for the work to be premiered. It's a compact piece, mostly in a stormy style with an unpredictable quality, lots of short phrases and dramatic pauses. And structurally, it's unusual. It doesn't have a conventional slow movement. Beethoven himself didn't expect the work to have popular appeal. He said, "The quartet is written for a small circle of connoisseurs and is never to be performed in public." Well, fortunately, the world caught up with his music, and now the piece is regarded as one of his most exciting, on a par with the Egmont Overture, which he wrote in the same year. So here comes the Brodsky Quartet to perform Beethoven's F minor quartet, Opus 95.
Thank you. Thank you.